We started this 34th week, the final week, with the great feast of Christ the King, the great solemnity of Jesus Christ, King of the universe, a joyful celebration in anticipation of the reign of Jesus. So we started on a positive note. And with that in mind, we can interpret everything else in a positive way, even the difficulties we pass through on the way. Yesterday we saw that extraordinary witness of the poor widow who put in her whole livelihood into the treasury. Well, how did she didn't even know about the reign of Christ the King, and yet she's an indicator of the kind of freedom that we have when we know God's in charge and he will take charge. So we don't have to worry about everything. Very positive. But today's readings remind us that there are stages to the establishment of this kingdom, and they're difficult. The first reading, coming from the book of Revelation, uses the image of the harvest of the wheat. It's harvest time, time to cut down the wheat. And the other image is the gathering of the grapes. It's vintage time, time to cut the grapes, throw them into the wine press. Well, is harvest time a time of joy or a time of sorrow? Usually, harvest time is a time of joy for the people who are going to get fresh wheat and fresh grapes, and they can make bread and they can make wine. But if you're a grape, you might not think it's such a great thing. Or if you're chaff, you might not think harvest time is a great thing because it's time for you to be cast aside or ground up or squished. So you see, it has two sides to it. But the point is, time comes to an end. There is a time when the process comes to its completion, and it's harvest time. Harvest time is, even in other cultures, a symbol of the end. Everybody has seen those images of death personified as a harvester. Black robe, big sickle, you know, a threatening figure who's going to cut everyone down. Harvest time. The other day I was out walking and there was a man picking the atis from the tree in front of his house, big atis. I said, oh, it must be harvest time. Thinking, oh, all the atis come at the same time. He said, well, actually, this tree bears fruit all year round. Kind of ruined the image. It's always harvest time for the atis. On the other hand, that's not a bad thing to realize. It's always harvest time. Meaning, we should always be ready for the end, or at least our own end, if not the end of the world. Well, in the Gospel, Jesus speaks about the end of the temple. Now, we know, everyone knows, that nothing lasts, that buildings fall apart, or are torn down, or are blown up, or there's earthquakes. We know that earthly things don't last. Everybody knows that. But we don't say it like that. And especially about precious buildings or historical monuments, we want to preserve them. Remember what the French did when Notre Dame Basilica caught on fire. They said, we're going to build it back just like it was. We're going to make it just like it was. We're not going to accept its demise or its destruction. And there's something right about that. Yes, we preserve what is of value to us. But Jesus says to the people who are admiring the beauty of the temple, he says, days will come when there will not be left a stone upon another stone that will not be thrown down. The destruction of the temple, which to the Jews meant the destruction of the chosen people. It meant something like the terrible experience they had in the Babylonian exile. The temple had been destroyed before, remember? And they had all been exiled. The city had been destroyed. They had rebuilt it after hundreds of years, and the temple had been rebuilt. Now this temple was the gem of Jerusalem. It was the center. It was the center of their faith, of their political, social life, everything. So to say it's going to be torn down is like saying it's the end of the world. Even though everybody knows no building lasts. Now, I know that in Jerusalem, some of you have been there, there are a few stones of the temple that are still there. Not every single stone is, there's one wall, the Wailing Wall of the temple. I think that's of the temple that Jesus was speaking in. Now, the temple in Jerusalem was destroyed in 70 AD. There was a Jewish rebellion against the Roman occupiers. Rome was fed up with the Jews and said, well, enough of this, we're going to tear down your temple, tear down your city and scatter you all around. And Christians, early Christians said, well, that was a fulfillment of what Jesus said here. Although some scholars say Luke's gospel was written after that had already happened. So in any case, it's clear that earthly things pass away. And the disturbed listeners say, well, when is this going to happen? And what are the signs? And Jesus says, well, don't get all caught up into the signs and the times, because there'll be lots of signs, and that doesn't necessarily mean that the end is immediately going to take place. These things will happen. When he mentions nation against nation and kingdom against kingdom, naturally we think of our own current circumstances. Here in the Philippines, probably everyone would think about the rising tension between the president and the vice president, or between the powerful families, Duterte's, Marcos's, or between the North and the South. I don't know. That's probably the first thing that comes to mind in the Philippines. But if we look beyond our neighborhood and the political dynasties here, we say, well, it's really about China and about tensions with her neighbors, or it's about North and South Korea, who are escalating their animosity. If you were living in Eastern Europe, you would immediately think of Ukraine and Russia. If you were in the Middle East, you would immediately think of the Israelis and the Palestinians. And depending on where people live, there's always some evidence that the end is coming, because there's always kingdom against kingdom and nation against nation. And that's always been like that. Now, in modern times, a mentality has arisen as a way of dealing with the inevitable destruction of everything. It's the secularist mentality. And the idea goes something like this. Well, since everything is meaningless anyway, everybody dies and everything is destroyed anyway, we'll just make the best of it. This is, I say, this arose largely in the 20th century, maybe a little bit in the late 19th century, Nietzsche, and then these existentialists like, what's his name, Jean-Paul Sartre, Albert Camus, and these guys. They say, okay, well, it's all meaningless, and life is meaningless. And we're all just specks of dust, living on a speck of dust in a vast empty space, and we're just accidents of forces of nature, and everything comes and goes, and there's no meaning, there's no good or bad, there's no right or wrong. And that's how people started to think, because they had no faith. So, well, if that's the case, if everything's meaningless, well, then why do anything? Why take on any project? Why even build a building in the first place? And they say, well, no, that's too depressing. It's too depressing to think everything's meaningless. So the answer of these philosophers is, you decide your own meaning. You take charge with the power of your will, and you impose meaning on your life. And that's how you become the victor in the meaninglessness of existence. I guess that sounds great to some people. It sounds pretty hollow to me. It sounds pretty empty. And if I say I'm imposing my meaning, I'm choosing the meaning of my life, well, it's still meaningless. And maybe to me, I think this is a great thing, or I think this is important. But to you, it's meaningless, because it doesn't come from you. And so that response of the existentialists, I mean the atheistic existentialists, it just seems like a kind of a desperate attempt not to despair. Then there are the people who've gone the route of a Buddhism or a kind of a Buddhist philosophy, detach yourself from the reality of suffering. Yes, it's everything is suffering and everything is painful and everything, there'll be lots of losses, but you can remove yourself from all that and live in a kind of peaceful harmony with reality without being too disturbed by it. Or the Stoics, I'm told there's been a resurgence of Stoicism, an ancient philosophy of the Stoics, a kind of a indifference. You cut yourself off from the painful realities. Again, maybe there's something heroic about that, but ultimately it's not very satisfying. Maybe you can say, I won't be moved by the destruction of a famous building, or I won't be disturbed when I hear about an earthquake. But what about when my own husband or wife or child is in the hospital? Am I not going to be moved by that? What about when I'm in the hospital? Is that going to be something I'm indifferent to, as though it doesn't make any difference? No, that doesn't make any sense to me. Well, anyway, I mentioned that because that's where the world is, but that's not where the church is. That's not where the life of faith is. And so Jesus saying, don't be worried about all these signs and about all these conflicts in the world. He can say that because, and it's not explicit in this section of the gospel, but he can say that because we're looking toward the victory of Jesus Christ. The end is not return to meaninglessness and nothingness. The end is fullness of glory, fullness of meaning, the victory of what is good and true, the victory of goodness over evil, the victory of life over death. And that's what we cling to. And that changes everything. If that's our perspective, which it is the perspective of faith, well then, life is not meaningless, and none of us is meaningless. In fact, nothing that we do is meaningless. We can make even the most insignificant moments of our life a gift, a participation in the great work of God. We can love. We can love even if no one knows it or notices it. And so, this is an exciting adventure. It's not a meaningless existence that we have to impose our own meaning on. No, we're brought into a very beautiful story. Now, yes, there are terrible chapters in the story, painful losses, but those are simply part of the progression of the establishment of something much more beautiful and precious. So that's where we are in this time of the year. We're not immune to experiencing the losses or experiencing fear of what is to come. We're not immune to that. We're real human beings and we experience reality. But we're not left on our own trying to either detach ourselves or impose our ideas. We're children of a loving Father who has a great plan for us. And that plan is what helps us make sense of all these conflicts and contradictions. Yes, makes sense. We can't understand it all, but we understand in the large part, well, this is God at work. So praise be to God. Let him finish his project and let us all be part of it.